you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and you know what? We're done.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm Emily Becker. On today's show, we'll hear interviews with two women of color restaurant owners, Judy Stokes of Derby and Maylin Chavez of Olympia Oyster Bar. In the second half of the show, we'll listen to an episode of Margin Podcast with host Jake Baez. Jake is the Portland-born son of Mexican parents who recently launched the food-focused Margin Podcast. Jake interviews Maylin Chavez, the chef and owner of Olympia Oyster Bar. They talk about the breadth of Mexican cuisines, Northwest native oysters, and some of the challenges she's confronted as a Mexican chef and restaurant owner. First up is an interview with Judy Stokes, owner of Derby in Kenton. Judy and I talk about all the changes she's made to keep her restaurant going during coronavirus times and to continue to support her Kenton neighbors. Judy has transformed her busy brunch spot by adding a market and deli. Similar to Maylin, Judy speaks to her challenges being a woman of color in the restaurant world.
I'm chatting with Judy Stokes, the owner of Derby, a brunch spot in Kenton. Derby is weathering the COVID storm in some really exciting ways. Thanks for being here, Judy.
Thank you.
So, Judy, you have been involved in the Portland restaurant industry, like, basically your whole life. Tell us about, you know, what led you to Derby.
So, I had moved out of Portland about 8 years ago, and I moved out to the Oregon coast, and it was nice. It was a really, really nice time out there, and it was beautiful, and I didn't really see myself at first moving back to the city just because of, you know, how everything was changing with, you know, the population, you know, growing and just, you know, everything becoming so busy. Traffic was increasing, the rent, you know, everything that, you know, Portland has become over the last like 6-7 years. So I kind of wanted out, and I just wanted a slower pace of life. And basically I think that I was just, my time was up out at the coast, and I honestly just really missed my family that is back here, and my, you know, my mom, my sister, her kids, and it just, I missed Portland. I mean, as much as anybody has any grievances about, you know, any city, when it comes down to it, I feel like Portland still has so much to offer, and it is such a wonderful city, and I've always loved it. I mean, it's always been home.
So you decided to open Derby in Kenton about 2 years ago, right?
Yes. I've been open now as of this last June 28th. I've been open for 2 years.
Awesome. As you noted, Portland's gone through a lot of changes. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about Derby is that it feels comfortable. It doesn't feel, you know, it doesn't feel like a brand new place. It, you know, you retained a lot of the charm of the neighborhood of what it was before, and you did your own thing. So just tell us like a little bit about what you were trying to do with Fairview when you opened it.
When I had decided that I wanted to come back home, but I didn't really know exactly what I would be doing career-wise, you know, if I was just going to go back to bartending or if I was going to maybe open up like another food cart, or I didn't really have a specific idea. But then I caught wind that Karen was selling the cup and saucer over there. And the minute I heard that, I just knew, I mean, in a heartbeat that it was going to be mine. I love Kenton. It's always been one of my favorite neighborhoods. I've always lived in North Northeast, and I was drawn to the area. I've always been drawn to that area because James, the chef at Poe Shines, is one of my most very best friends. I've known him for about 27, 28 years, and he's also been a wonderful mentor to me, and he's taught me so much in the kitchen over the years, and he's been such a huge support in all of my prior businesses. But Kenton also, so being close to him was important. I knew I would get that support that still felt like community. And basically just Kenton still feels like that old Portland. It still feels like home. You know, it's changing just like any little hub in the metropolitan area or Portland proper, but it also, you know, it's one of the last ones, but it still has such a wonderful sense of community where people make a point to know each other and people make a point to pop by and say hi. It is a residential neighborhood, so people, there's so many wonderful families and young families, and it just still felt like home, even though it's changing, which is fine. I mean, change is change. It's going to happen, but it's still just, there's something about the integrity of Kenton that just feels so comfortable and safe to me.
Speaking of changes, Derby's gone through a lot recently, as has the whole restaurant scene in Portland. Governor Brown issued her Stay Home, Save Lives order in mid-March, and at that point, you know, lots of restaurants shut down. Some of them recently reopened, some of them haven't, some of them are closing permanently. Eaterpedix has a really sad list of all of the restaurants that have closed permanently due to COVID-19. It's kind of a little bit heartbreaking sometimes to read through that, and I'm so pleased that so many restaurants have been able to innovate and be creative and figure out ways to survive and to thrive. And I was hoping you could kind of walk us through some of what you've gone through since mid-March.
Sure. Well, basically, you know, that was obviously a very smart thing to do, to have all the restaurants closed down. And I know that a lot of us owners were, you know, really hoping that that would happen just so that, you know, it would keep us safe along with everybody else. So I was more than happy to do that. Of course, there's still so many questions. People really don't know what direction exactly we're all going to go into. And seeing that list and hearing, you know, daily who's closing, I know that we all feel the same way collectively, all of us restaurateurs. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's, you know, it hits you in the gut because we know how much time and love we put in this industry, and it is our lives. I mean, it breaks my heart every time I hear it because I just could imagine what people are going through, and I might be next. You never know. But I closed down for 2 months, and there were a lot of things going on with me personally. So to be honest, it was kind of a little bit of a saving grace for me. There was a lot of silver lining, and I got to, you know, I had to move, and I put, you know, my dog down 14 years during that time. There were just so many things going on, but I knew that I couldn't be shut down forever because I'm so new, and, you know, I had worked for 20 years to get to this point, you know, whether it be working the floor or bartending or cleaning people's houses to, like, save money to do this, and you know, I didn't have big time backers behind me. And so I still, you know, I still owe investors. It wasn't a choice for me to close down. And so I had to keep going, and I had to, you know, pretty much figure out a way to pivot and to make it work to where I can keep going. And I've always wanted to put a little market in Kenton because we need one. The closest markets are a mile each way, so there's nowhere, you know, where you can conveniently on foot go grab a loaf of bread or, you know, some eggs or anything like that, and we don't have a deli. I had been looking into doing that before the pandemic hit, and with this, I had time to sit and plan something out as quick as I could to turn the restaurant into a market. Since I already had the space, I figured I would just kind of go with it, and so I did. And I put all of my tables and chairs in booth and storage, all my dishware, glassware, everything. And as best I could, just thrifted, you know, shelving and equipment, and got some new stuff in so that I can still feed the neighborhood. So I one big thing that I did was I popped out the window where my bar is, and I put a slider window in there, so I've got a takeout delivery window, so I can still offer my menu, which I love. I love feeding people. I mean, I'm Filipino. I want to feed people, and I wanted to continue on with the menu that I've been working with since I opened. So you can still come and, you know, call in. You can walk up. You can order online, and you can, now that we're in phase one, you can sit outside at the picnic tables. But also, you know, with the market, you can come in and get goods for your kitchen and all of your staples and some produce. And I have a deli now where you can, you know, I know a lot of people are really, really tired of cooking, especially from hearing from my friends who have kids who all of a sudden they're at home, you know, with their kids who can't go back to school, and they're cooking all day, every day, and they're exhausted. So I'm just doing a lot of, you know, grab and go, take and bakes, just kind of trying to take the load off of parents and, you know, whoever else in the neighborhood. And, you know, a lot of us are still really busy, and we're always on the go. So it's convenient. So that's kind of what I was hoping to do, was offer conveniency to the neighborhood, but also bringing in, you know, specialty products. You know, a lot of the specialty lines that I have, most specialty products that I have in the market, if they're not made in Portland, they're made in the Northwest. But I'm also focusing on women-owned companies and women of color. So I'm trying to get, you know, products in, go in that direction. There's a bunch of really wonderful, talented people in this town, as you know, in this industry. So I'm happy to, you know, try to keep them all in business too, and give them all a nod and sell their products so that we both can keep going.
Yeah, what an awesome collaboration, or like a way to support your community. And also just to have that kind of curation is really nice. Go into a market and know that everything's been selected with intention. It's really, really wonderful. So we're living in a time where the Black Lives Matter movement is really ever present in our lives, and it's really pushing a lot of people to think about and to question our assumptions about race and about all sorts of other intersectionalities. And so I'm wondering if you've come across any challenges in owning a restaurant that you can attribute to being a woman, to being Filipina, that you see any hope for resolving, or you see any progress for getting to a better place now that we have kind of this momentum happening.
I do. I think that I think people are listening. You know, it's taken a lot, and it's going to take a lot more, and it always will, but I think that people are listening. And I think that, you know, where we shouldn't have to be, I think that we're being validated a lot more. And I think that we're, you know, being credited a lot more instead of always having to prove ourselves. You know, unfortunately, I feel like it's more internal as a woman. I feel like the hurdles are internal. You know, being a woman in the kitchen, it's tough. It's always been tough. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. You know, no matter what anybody says, like, oh, there's this chef, and she's a woman, and she's, you know, got these accolades, and absolutely. But the thing is, you know, we have had to work twice as hard for that respect. I feel like people don't take me seriously outside of the restaurant until they know that I own a restaurant, which is unfortunate. But I think that that's also very much an economical viewpoint that people have. So, you know, there's been a lot of times where I present myself and, you know, for example, say I want to get a new, you know, distributor, a new purveyor, I want to get a new account with somebody. And if I inquire about a company or their products, I get a lot of slough off until I tell them, oh, you know, well, I own a restaurant. And then all of a sudden people perk up. So it's just a really strange initial reaction that people have upon meeting, I think, a woman, especially a minority woman, because they don't expect that. But it's just funny because there's been numerous instances where people don't warm up to me until I say, like, oh, I own a restaurant. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm validating their time and their conversation with me.
I hear you. People should interact with you as a human asking to bring an account on, and it shouldn't have anything to do with your gender or your ethnicity. And yet we live in a society where people will just automatically discount people because of those things.
Right.
You know, something that a lot of people are trying to change right now, and a lot of people are resisting that change. Well, thanks so much, Judy. If people want to find out what's on your menu or come visit the market, how can they do that?
So I'm located at 8237 North Denver. I'm in, once again, the old cup and saucer space. I'm still doing breakfast, lunch, and brunch. I do have social media, so if you're on Instagram or Facebook and you look up Derby Kenton, I should pop up. And we are open every day now except for Tuesday, so I'm trying to go full force and, you know, I'm trying to do the best that I can to catch up financially and just to gain some kind of momentum in all of this, and just to let everybody know that I'm still there for them, and I want to feed them. I want to feed Kenton, and then people make the trek up to North Portland. You know, I'm a block off the mat. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Judy.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Welcome to Margin. Mexico is the United States' closest neighbor to the south, and in fact, a great portion of the land that now makes up the southwestern United States was once Mexican territory. I have kind of a contentious relationship with identification in my own culture, while simultaneously feeling a longing and a passion for its windswept hills and its beautiful people. As familiar and comforting as some people find the cuisine, along with the stereotypes, it is striking how little the average U.S. citizen knows about this dynamic and passionate country, its people, or its cuisine. On a quest to understand some of the many nuances of my home country's food, I was fortunate enough to find a voice of clarity in Chef Mylene Chavez, owner and head chef of Olympia Oyster Bar on Mississippi. Chef Mylene brought her powerful memories from a coastal Mexican childhood to bear through her food at OOB. And although, as you'll hear, the state of our world has presented some challenges, her spirit and dedication shine through in a way that can only be described as inspirational. She's not the one who jumps off the bridge when her friends do. She's at the bottom, waiting to catch them. Putting her whole heart and soul into her food and the way that she interacts with the world, I believe the message that I received loud and clear from this chat. Pour your whole self into your passions, and even in the vulnerability of being all in, greatness will find you.
I hear you, I don't see you. There you are.
Okay, there I am.
Hi.
How are you?
You know, man, been a weird emotional few days, or a few weeks, I guess.
Yeah.
For so many reasons, you know, it's the feelings and the climate is just intense right now, and it's a lot, but we're hanging in there.
Yeah. That's all we can do, right?
Yeah, that's all we can do. That's all we can do.
My camera is over here, but I've got your window on this monitor over here, so I'm going to not be looking at you, but I'm looking
okay.
At you.
It's all good.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure. I didn't know you existed until just a little bit ago, and it's truly an honor to get some time with a chef from Mexico.
Thank you.
You know, cuisine is big for me.
Yeah.
And I haven't spoken with someone who has made their career out of it from Mexico. It's something that's really near and dear to my heart. I really applaud you for choosing this career path, and it's very enviable.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really sweet of you. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course. I guess, you know, from my personal experience, Mexican cuisine feels like a big hug to me.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's so embedded in tradition and culture and heritage. And, you know, looking at just the different regions of Mexico and how each region really is distinct and it tells a story. You know, I just came back from Oaxaca. I was there in January, right before all the craziness happened. And it was such an amazing experience because, you know, Oaxacan cuisine, I believe that it is truly kind of at the core of Mexican cuisine as a whole in the whole republic, and it tells such a story about indigenous ways of cooking and our ancestors, and it is such a big hug. It is so embedded in that sense of community, that sense of tradition, that sense of healing as well, healing through food and healing through family, and it's It really is, I think, such an enormous expression of our culture. And I want to say more so than many other cultures. It is very unique.
And it's incredible because Mexico is so diverse. The different states and the different people that make up its cultural base. You know, I feel like the cuisine really reflects elements of that passion across the culture. Do you have any dishes that evoke those same memories for you?
Yeah, I do. You know, there's so many, but there's a few that I have actually been able to share here in Portland when I had my restaurant, and one of them is called chilpachole. And chilpachole is this beautiful, just intense broth. It's kind of a shrimp stock, crab stock based broth, but it is one of the most soulful, soothing broths. My grandmother, who is for me has always been my inspiration, may she rest in peace, she was this tremendous cook, and she told stories through food. And this dish really kind of epitomized that essence. You know, it has cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, you know, chili peppers, and this base of like shrimp shells and crab shells. So it's this like aromatic, warming, soothing broth that I swear to God, actually a lot of my staff these days are like, oh, we miss your broth. Can you make some for us? And it's one of those things when I was like preparing it at the restaurant, you would walk in and you can just smell it. And it's this such a soothing dish for me that it really just, I think it epitomizes that hug that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my grandmother, and it's, you know, her stories through her traditions and her family, and it's just such a beautiful dish. But for me, that's a dish that I always try to prepare, especially with my family and my friends, and especially during the holidays. It's such a warming dish.
Wonderful. I really would be interested in trying that at some point. Maybe we'll be able to get together and cook for each other.
Yes, absolutely. I have a little bit more time these days, so I'll make a pot.
That sounds great. I feel like it's a tragedy because so many of these dishes are so, I guess, people are sleeping on them. They don't really get a whole lot of press because there's a large misconception about Mexican culture, not just in the cuisine, but also born of like caricatures of supporting mice in Speedy Gonzalez cartoons.
Oh my God, yes.
Frito Bandito, you know, like people being sleepy and lazy. And it's just,
yes,
it's just not true. It's just not what our culture is.
It's so true. And you know what? You bring such a great point because this particular dish at the restaurant, I had to change the name of it many times because people didn't understand it. And they're like, well, is it Chopino? And I was like, well, no, it's not Chopino. Is it a stew? No, it's not a stew. It's its own dish. And I had to change the name of the dish so people would order it and understand it, which is so unfortunate to me. And I think because my restaurant wasn't named, it's not, you know, it wasn't a Mexican restaurant. It was a restaurant that I cooked for. You know, it was my restaurant and my heritage and my cuisine, and it was my style of cooking and where I come from. So that you bring such an interesting point to that because I had to change that name several times in order for people to get it.
In these conversations that I've been having with people who cook recently,
yeah,
I've been noticing a recurring thread, a lot of it having to do with changing the way that something is presented or perhaps the ingredients that are used to be a little bit more accessible. And to me, that feels like a bit of a tragedy because the perspective of a diner is one of consumption,
right,
rather than absorbing or really trying to truly understand, if not the theory behind the food, then at least the method behind the chef and how they prepare things.
Right.
I think that's a tragedy, and really, I don't know. I don't have a good answer. Like, how do we fix that?
Yeah, you know, and we, you know, we as a team, I would, you know, we'd have conversations at the restaurant. I would, you know, talk to my staff, and they would try to get creative with how we can present this. And they would always share my story to the guests. You know, our chef is from Mexico, and this is from Baja, and you know, a coastal town, and this is the approach, and this is why she serves oysters with limes and not lemons, and this is why we don't have horseradish, and these. So they would try to tell that story. And for the most part, I think the majority of our guests, especially as through the years, they started getting it little by little.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding, you know, the vibe of the restaurant. But it is challenging.
Yeah, the average dinner goer probably feels like they have a very specific, broad interpretation of what Mexican food is. But there's just such a wealth of cuisines that they've never seen. What are your favorite hidden gems of Mexican cuisine outside of your personal experience? Maybe some other Sinaloense guilty pleasures?
Well, yeah, of course. Well, my grandmother was from Sinaloa. So yeah. For me, growing up with my grandma, it's, you know, I mean, it's all about, you know, the aguachiles and, you know, the zarandeados and, you know, pescados a la talla. And, you know, again, very seafood. For my grandmother, she loved the sea. But it's like these spices and these chilies, you know, and it's, I mean, Sinaloense food is just, I mean, it's one of the best in my book. And it's, again, very much, you know, my grandmother, her family was from Andalusia, Spain. So she had a little bit of kind of that Spanish, the Moors. She would have a lot of, you know, those spices that she would incorporate. And then you couple that with the Sinaloense food and the aguachiles, and just, it was this magical palette full of just different flavor profiles and spices. But yeah, I mean, for me, Sinaloense food is one of my favorite. And also, you know, food from Puebla. I have a lot of family in Puebla, and, you know, you can't, I mean, moles and more meats for sure. I'm a pescatarian, so I gear more towards the seafood, but, you know, you have these beautiful moles and these beautiful sauces, and it's just, again, it's so diverse. And I think that if you're not making arroz y frijoles and, you know, enchiladas, a lot of people, especially up here in the Pacific Northwest, they don't understand. They don't understand that Mexican cuisine really, I mean, has influences from the Middle East. It has influences from Asia and Japan. I mean, in Baja California, it's a lot of Japanese influence. We use a lot of soy sauce. We use a lot of sesame seeds. We use a lot of umami-driven flavors in our food. And it's important for people to really kind of expose themselves to that because it is very vast.
Yeah, I mean, some of those things that you're talking about, sesame seeds and peanuts, even there's a, you know, the marketed really popular candy of cacahuates japoneses, but they're not
right.
They're not actually Japanese. It's just like the style that we.
They're so good.
They're very good. You talk about seafood. I spent time with my family in Veracruz, and
yeah,
being by the ocean and experiencing these restaurants that have such a variety of seafood dishes. Aside from ceviche, aside from mojarra, they're very intensely regionally specific, and I really feel like there could be a strong market for that type of cuisine here in the Pacific Northwest specifically, because they get seafood, you know?
Right, exactly. But you know what, you would be surprised that, you know, it hasn't been until the last few years that I have seen, especially here in Portland, seafood be more prevalent. When I first started, I was one of few. I opened the restaurant in 2015, and I was one of few that was doing seafood, not, you know, in your kind of more East Coast way where it's like the clam chowders, the fish and chips, fish sandwiches. It was, you know, just a different approach to seafood. And little by little, you know, you start seeing like Jacqueline, you start seeing Headwaters, Flying Fish, you know, more and more restaurants doing more of an ample seafood dishes. But it's taken Portland a little bit, I believe, and I'm still trying to figure out how, you know, we're so close to the coast and we have such bounty, you know, and then we have Seattle next, our neighbors, who are very seafood driven and very seafood centric, but we're still kind of in that comfort meat and potatoes kind of environment. So I think little by little, hopefully people will start getting it. But my grandfather was from Veracruz too, and you know, it's, again, it's just these vast, you know, whole pescados a la talla, huachinango, and all these amazing ways of preparing seafood that it's, hopefully we can see more and more of that out here.
I mean, seafood is way up there as far as favorite cuisines of mine. I'm curious how you ended up gravitating towards oysters or specifically, and seafood in general.
Yeah, so growing up in Baja and with my grandparents, we always were at the beach. You know, for us, that was the pastime. My grandmother, she, you know, was a competitive swimmer. My grandfather, you know, again, very political, but he was always camping and going out, and we were crabbing and, you know, taking out the choros or mejillones, you know, right off the rocks. And so for us, it was part of our interaction every weekend. So when I started kind of getting into cooking as a profession, I always geared towards that, because that's, for me, that's always been my flavor profiles. It's nostalgic to me, and anything that kind of provides that nostalgia, that's home, I'm going to try to go for it. However, with oysters, what really prompted me to get into this specific, very niche business was that I met some farmers in San Diego who had been also working with farmers in Baja. And they were called Carlsbad Aqua Farm in San Diego, this really cool little farm, and these two scientists, marine biologists, started farming there. And they, you know, said, Mylene, I was cooking at an event. She's like, you need to come out. So I went to the farm, and I fell in love with aquaculture, and I fell in love with the idea of this little beautiful animal that gives back to the environment, you know, that doesn't take. It's like, nope, I'm not going to take anything away. I'm just going to, you know, provide all these good things for you, and then, you know, I taste good too. I started learning more and more about aqua farming and aquaculture, and I just became really just interested in this whole other aspect that I didn't know growing up. I mean, I saw oysters, I eat oysters, I harvested them, you know, off the beaches with my grandfather, but not this other part of it. So when I was working on this concept, I said, you know, this is the perfect combination of all the things that make me happy. It's the ocean, it's good for us, it's good for the environment, and it tells a story of time and place. So from there, that's actually where I got the name from. The farmers ended up discovering this little oyster called the Olympia oyster growing wild in the lagoon. And that was my first introduction to the Olympia oyster. And I just, again, fell in love with the story of this little oyster that, you know, nearly became extinct in the 1900s, you know, late 1800s, really trying to make a comeback and looking at restoration efforts for that oyster. And again, I fell in love with it. And it was this instant connection that I had. It just made sense because I love oysters. I'm obsessed with oysters. But the idea of working with an ingredient that provides and doesn't take, for me, that was the win-win.
That's amazing. I know that Olympia oysters are really similar to a variety that's found actually in Baja, where mm-hmm. where you spend a lot of time.
Yeah.
So that probably was another call back to home, like, hey, this looks a lot like an oyster that you were familiar with. And
exactly.
I mean, it is a hell of a comeback story. I mean, they nearly went extinct because of the 1840s, 1850s, like the gold rush era. People just kind of...
Yeah. Over-harvested, you know, and then over-harvesting and then water pollution, ocean acidification. It's the native oyster. So it's the only native oyster to the West Coast. So it's the only oyster that belongs in the West Coast. So that story is really unique and it's really powerful as well.
Yeah. Talking about you establishing these partnerships with local farmers, how has your work of farm-to-bar concept established partnerships with growers that have dedicated themselves to the revival of the Olie?
Yeah, so for me, when I decided to, because I moved to Portland to open a restaurant specifically, that was my sole purpose. And I immediately began to reach out to the farms and the farmers, asking about the Olies and asking about, you know, what are they doing? Remember, the first people that I met was Betsy Peabody. And Betsy Peabody is the executive director of the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. And her sole purpose is to restore the Olympia oysters, which is amazing. And they're doing such great work. And I met her through my friends at Hama Hama, Adam James and Lisa James, who are just this beautiful, amazing, hardworking family, fifth generation farm. So for me, it was really important to make those connections and reach out and find out, you know, how can I support as a business owner, as a business that's going to tell the story? And my business is going to be named after this oyster. So I want to make sure that I'm able to educate my guests, my patrons, but also truly understand, you know, how important is this little oyster to the community, to our environment? You know, the Olympia oyster, because it's the native oyster, it's the only oyster that's resilient to bacteria, resilient to certain plagues. The majority of the oysters that were brought back from Japan don't have that resiliency. So understanding this oyster and being able to work with it and also educate people about it and understand it, I think that creates a platform to create that awareness while also supporting the farms and truly being connected to those farms. So for me, it was really important to, again, making those connections, being a part of it, going out there, working the tide. For me, being able to be in the water and having my hands in on that ground and that wet, muddy sand, you know, with all the seaweed, all the good stuff, and pulling out, you know, all of those oysters and understanding their environment and truly being able to tell that story from farm to bar is important. And again, it was part of my journey to be able to be proud of an ingredient that I work with.
That's incredible. It's interesting that you bring up the Japanese or Pacific oysters. They're a lot more common in any area where you might find an oyster bar. And it's strange because the Olympia is more resilient. And I would say probably the most notable difference is the size. Big Taste comes in smaller packages potentially. So can you tell me a little bit about the flavor differences there?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Olympia oyster, it's its own species, right? So there's five species of oysters. You have your Pacific, your Kumamoto, your flats, your Virginicas, and then your Olies. So each species of oyster obviously is going to have their different flavor profiles. And also oysters are impacted by the environment that they're cultivated in. So if you have an oyster that's cultivated, you know, up in the Puget Sound versus Neatarts Bay, their flavors are going to be distinct. However, the Olympia, it doesn't grow bigger than the size of a sand dollar. So it's this tiny little oyster. It's in the family of a European flat. So it's going to be a flat, you know, it's not going to have a lot of meat to it. It's super small, but it's going to have a lot of radish notes, copper notes. You know, it's going to be a little bit metallic, depending on the seasonality as well. So if it's May, closer towards the end of its season, if the water is a little colder, all of that's going to impact the flavor profile. But the olies are packed with flavor. Sometimes they're a little briny, but again, it all depends where they're cultivated. Because that's, you know, it's like the merlot versus the terroir. You know, in wine, you know, depending on the soil, if there's limestone around, the Appalachian, you know, the how close to the ocean they are, that's going to impact that flavor. And oysters are the same. They're filter feeders, so they're going to take all of that flavor that is in their environment, and they're really going to absorb that, and you're going to taste that in that oyster, which is why oysters are so nostalgic as well, because you can actually taste, like, you taste the Kumeyaay oyster from Baja, that grassy. I mean, that's home right there. They start them off in Guerrero, then they finish them off in Ensenada to kind of refresh them, but you can taste that environment in those oysters.
That's incredible. It's really similar to how people say, you know, the water here is different, the produce here is different. You know, it's the Willamette Valley. Like, it's incredible. So people could probably really understand
right. That
concept as applied in that way. I think one of the tragic realities about the American diner is the unintentional and casual driving influence on culinary trends.
Right.
Diners seek exotic food, and then they potentially ask for substitutions for ingredients that they can't really palate. You know, they don't understand. And it's for someone who cooks, for someone who presents food to receive that kind of a request, it kind of kills you a little bit inside, just little by little.
Yeah, I mean, it does. At the restaurant, I never served cocktail sauce or horseradish, and that was a conversation, especially the first 2 years, that, you know, when people would ask for it, or if they asked if I had ketchup.
Wow.
I was like, oh no. like my heart hurts, like, oh, you're just killing my soul. But then, you know, I would encourage them, you know, very kindly encourage them to try something different. That's why they're coming to the restaurant, for a different experience, and for them to you know, hopefully experiment with other flavors. And if they don't like it, then okay. They'll get their cocktail sauce at another place at another time. But today, this is what they're going to get. But it is. It hurts your soul a little bit.
What percentage of your work do you think is, like, educational or evangelical for customers who are convinced that, like, bigger is better, or they want ketchup,
yeah,
or, you know?
I want to say the first 2 years were the hardest, and I want to say probably, you know, 60% of the time we were having to encourage and educate our diners as to what we were doing, because it was, when we first opened, like, for example, that it was a big issue that we didn't sever the bottom muscle of the oysters. I would just shuck them and then obviously remove the top shell and leave that bottom muscle attached. And for me, that was important because it not only tells the guest that the oyster is fresh, that it's alive, but I also wanted to keep that integrity of that oyster as long as possible until the actual guest enjoyed it. And that's how it's done in the rest of the world. So I think in America, it's really the only country that they really sever that bottom muscle. And that was a huge, huge ordeal. I mean, that was, you know, it would get people upset, and I get it. You know, I get it. They don't want to bother with removing that muscle. But I was, you know, wanted to have it be very true to what I believed in. And I wanted to, you know, really maintain the integrity of that oyster as much as possible. And after a few years, you know, I think people started getting it. From time to time, we would still have a few people that would put up a fight and then would just release it for them and, you know, okay, here you go.
Yeah, you got to pick the hill that you want to die on, definitely.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, it's clear that you're an expert in your field, and it's difficult because I feel that this isn't really talked about much outside of person of color circles, but I'd like to know a little bit about the potential racial bias or the sexism bias that you may have faced in your professional industry. Can you discuss a little bit of your experience as an entrepreneur of color?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's constant, and sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's not. I think, you know, at the restaurant, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, well, actually not everywhere, I've experienced it everywhere. You know, I have one incident that stands out. We had group of people come in. I was in the kitchen. My front of the house manager was attending them, and they, you know, they asked to get lemons, and they said, "Sure, you know, we serve them with limes, but I'm happy to give you guys lemons. We're not going to be, you know, we're not going to annoy you and not give you what you want in that regard. You know, we're happy to do so. You know, why are we getting limes? You know, with oysters? Oysters should come with lemons." It's like, oh well, our chef is from Mexico. And, you know, in Mexico, you know, limes are served with oysters, but also West Coast oysters pair really well with limes. And East Coast oysters tend to do better with lemon, but, you know, West Coast, you know, it's intentional. This is why we're serving it with limes. And they said, oh, those, you know, those damn Mexicans and their food and their limes, right? And I could hear them. I'm just sitting in the kitchen just watching this. Just calmly, you know, observing one of my staff, and, you know, of course she handled it beautifully and said, well, everybody has different preferences, and this is why, you know, we're so happy that we're providing cuisine that's different, because, you know, that's what cuisine is about. It's about exploring different heritages and different ways of eating food. But sure, I'll bring you your lemons, right? So then she came back around, and I was like, oh, let me take some lemons. I want to go and, you know, have an opportunity to chat with them. And that's the thing. For me, it's you know, as you get older, you kind of develop that thick skin, and hopefully try to create some educational opportunities in that moment and surprise people, you know? And because I don't, you know, in their mind, I don't fit their stereotype of what, you know, a Mexican woman looks like. You know, in a way, I could use that to my benefit. So I walked over to the table and I was like, hi, guys, you know, so you have some questions about, you know, the citrus that we use for the oysters. And yeah, you know what, your chef is Mexican, like, you know, what don't they know that this is America and that, you know, they should just give us what we need? And I said, well, you know, sir, yeah, I'm the chef and I'm also the owner. And yeah, you know, I can definitely understand that you're used to having lemons with your oysters. However, in Mexico, we know a thing or two about food. So I would highly encourage you to enjoy these limes. And I didn't, that's all I said. And they just looked at me with their eyes open and they're like, oh, well, we didn't mean to offend you. I'm like, no, you actually did.
Yeah.
But it's okay. I'm not offended. I just hope that you learned something new today. And I walked away. And it was just that moment where you're just, it's almost comical. You know, it's almost comical to see the level of crass, the level of ignorance, and just how flippant people can be with their words. Thank goodness that I'm pretty strong, and you know, I think most of us who, you know, grew up in with a Mexican family, you know, we don't shy away easily. you know, especially we have our Mexican moms and grandmas, and you know, they've taught us well. But it's you know, that's just one of many. You know, I think being a woman, being Mexican, and being up here in the Pacific Northwest, and being very proud of my heritage. Like, I am the first one to say where I'm from, and my first language is Spanish, and I'm very proud of it. And I think that when people see me and they hear my confidence and they hear me feeling empowered with my position and what I can do, and hopefully who else I can support and bring to that table, I think it kind of, you're taken back a little bit. You know, they don't know how to react at times. And it's, you know, even as a woman of color chef, they, again, they always think that the, you know, all my cooks are the chefs, and they always look past me. Or they're talking to the guy, my guy on the line, and they're not talking to me. It's constant. And this happens, I mean, this happens globally, unfortunately, I think, in our industry. But, and then I remember one other time where one of my cooks spoke Spanish and was wanting to learn, more Spanish. So I was like, absolutely, like, you know, let's practice. So I was talking to him Spanish on the line, and this guest that came in and was just, oh, well, I can't understand what you guys are saying. You know, it was right on the bar, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry, sir. Did you have a question, or were you wanting to know what we're talking about? But it was, again, these comments and these, and I get that a lot. You know, that one, this one lady, this was actually when we were opening the restaurant, right before somebody came in to sell something, and I was on the phone with my friends at Baja Shellfish Farms talking about oysters, and I was speaking Spanish to them, and the lady came in, and she said, wow, your Spanish is really great. I said, oh, yeah. I said, thank you. And I get that a lot. You know, I get that all the time.
It should
all
be.
All the time. I was like, great. And I said, well, thank you. You know, it's my first language, actually. And my English isn't great at times, but my Spanish is spot on. She's like, oh, well, your first language? Where are you from? You know, I'm like, oh, I'm from Mexico. Oh, really? Oh, it's okay, honey. You don't look Mexican.
Oh.
That's what she said. You know? And I looked at her, and I said, I'm sorry. What did you mean by that? Well, you know, it's like, you're okay. Hey, I'm sorry, I still don't understand. What do you mean by that? Well, you know what I mean. I was like, no, I do not know what I mean. Please, elaborate. I'm intrigued to know what you really meant by that comment. And she didn't say anything and just walked away. You know, so it's one of so many. You know, so many that you can just pinpoint. And it, at the end of the day, you know, you hope that your responses can create some type of, or plant a seed to have people rethink their comments or rethink their mentality. And I feel like sometimes I've had those opportunities where I'm able to do that and I'm able to break through, because I do feel empowered using my voice, and not many of our people do. And I feel like if I can speak, you know, for you know, my paisanos and my people, you know, it's I'm going to try to do it. But I think that it's hard, you know, it's a hard kind of balance to be able to work with at times. It really is.
I found that those six words are the magic words. What did you mean by that? No matter what the horrible opinion, no matter what position they stand in, it's usually fueled by ignorance and other people around them not voicing their discomfort. And so all it takes is you asking them to define what their statements make, and it, all of a sudden it stops being a game.
Right, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I heard you talk about, well, mostly your experience as far as a person of color, but I know that there's this implicit boys club culture in the cooking world.
Yeah.
You know, making it harder for non-male professionals to access permitting or funds to help them get established. And really, your success to me speaks to you being one of the toughest chefs around.
Thank you.
Of course.
That means a lot. Thank you.
Of course.
You know, it's you know, I think it's being a you know, a woman business owner, independent business owner, you have to be more assertive. You have to find your voice, and you have to find that confidence, even when, you know, in the moment you show your confidence and you go home and you're like, okay, I'm gonna cry for a minute. You know, it's people will try to take advantage of you by trying to charge you more money, by trying to pull fast ones on you, by, you know, you're the nice person, you know, and oh, you ask Maylene, she'll do anything, and yeah, we can get away with not, you know, making sure that she's taken care of. It's a lot of that. So it's a fine balance, and it's the balance where I have to find in myself where I still want to be true to my spirit and who I am. You know, I'm a very nurturing, warm person. For me, people always come before anything else. How I treat people come before business, come before the bottom line. For me, that's the most important thing. But I still have to be strong, and I still have to stand on my ground and still be true to what's right. You know, at the end of the day, it's what's right and what's wrong and what's just. And I think right now we're experiencing that on a mass level, and we've been experiencing that for decades and centuries of oppression in our world, and especially in this country. And, you know, how do you find that balance, right, of being true to your soul, being true to your spirit, while still asserting yourself and saying, I have a place here, this is my voice, and you're not going to step all over me, and you're not going to come in here and try to humble me in the way that you want to humble me. And that takes a lot of exercise. You have to exercise that ability throughout your whole life, you know, by getting hit, by being, how do you say it in English? Like humillada, you know, like when your dignity is being threatened.
Resiliency, maybe.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Resiliency. Yeah.
It's another common thread across these conversations that I'm having, that people just have thicker skin. And I feel like that's, you know, the more challenge you face, the thicker your skin gets.
Right.
And really, you're no stranger to critical thought in subjects of equity and advocacy. I know that you studied criminal justice, law, and human behavior all before turning towards the culinary arts in 2011.
Yes.
Can I ask what drove you to switch from one to the other?
Oh, yes. You know, I did that for, 15 years. I did public service work, you know, restorative justice, advocacy, both in Mexico and in the States. And it got to a point that my heart was hurting. Because, you know, you start seeing the worst of humanity and the worst of the worst. And you get to a point where you're just like, I don't want it to jade me. I don't want it to change my optimism and my positivity and my love for humanity. And I loved cooking, and I've always been kind of for me, cooking has always been a therapy, has always been a space for expression with my family and, you know, within my culture. So when I made the decision, you know, everything somewhat aligned. I was working with the prosecutor's office, and our elected DA was not reelected, and this other DA was elected that was not, you know, not, I didn't stand for his values, and I didn't sell out. I was very vocal how I did not agree with his rhetoric and his values, and as a result, myself and my boss and other friends and who were my colleagues, we all essentially got booted out. Laid off. We were part of the executive management team, and, you know, they were coming in with a whole new cabinet. So in that moment, you know, I started interviewing in LA. I started interviewing for other positions that worked on like binational work. And I just, you know, I just had to reassess and really think about, is this, do I want another 20 years of this? Do I want to just take a step and truly follow this passion of mine that is still a form of expression, and it's still a form of being around happiness and still being able to provide comfort to people, but in a different way. And I really wanted that. And during those few months we were going through this transition with my job, I was doing events. I was cooking and doing these wellness and yoga retreats out of my home in California. And I was loving it. And I was making a little money. I was like, hey, this could work. You
know? Yeah.
I'm yoga, I'm drinking wine, I'm cooking. It's like, oh, this is awesome. So I took a leap of faith, and I'm not shy of hard work. I've always been I have 4 degrees for the love of God. You know, it's like I'm crazy. I was like, I don't know why I did any of that, but, you know, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do something different that was still true to myself and true to my spirit, and something that I've always wanted to do. But in my mind, you know, it wasn't the responsible thing to do. It wasn't the, you know, no, I got to follow the route. You know, my parents worked hard so I can go to school. And so I got laid off January 3rd, and then I enrolled in culinary school in January 11th. And for me, having that fundamental education for a lot of people, culinary school isn't, it's a waste of time, and I get it. But for me, because I knew how to cook, I grew up cooking, but I wanted to understand the profession. I wanted to understand kind of the fundamentals of what the profession really entailed. And for me, that was helpful. And then from there, just, you know, started really identifying myself with people that I wanted to work with, that I wanted to learn from. And of course, I navigated towards working with chefs in Baja. And I started working at this amazing five-star resort called Rancho La Puerta in Tecate, which is this beautiful, you know, very wellness-oriented, because, again, I'm trying to find my zen. You know, my happy place. And then they have this beautiful, they have this gorgeous 6-acre organic farm on site, who the farmer, Salvador, is just this amazing farm whisperer. And I had the opportunity to work there for a while. And then they still invite me back because it's also a culinary school. So they teach cooking classes to people and to the guests that show up. And they really, you know, want to kind of expose people to the cultures of Mexico and the bounty of, you know, the Valle de Guadalupe and Ensenada and So for me, that was just home. It's always been home to me, and that really kind of propelled my career in many different ways.
Chef, I have to say my admiration for you has only grown. I really can tell that your previous work really shines through in what
Thank
you're
you.
Doing today.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, man. Thank you. That's really sweet.
Of course.
Thank you.
May I ask about OOB?
Yes.
The Mississippi location is currently closed. What happened, and is that permanent?
Yes. So our lease ended in December, and the numbers didn't align for us for the renewal. They wanted a little bit more money than we were willing to pay. And we, you know, pre-COVID, when we closed, we had the plans to do events and pop-ups, which we were doing up until COVID made everything shut down. And we were going to open the Oyster Bar at the coast, but because of everything that's gone on and many other things, we are not going to be able to be doing that. But the goal, hopefully, is once this kind of transition of where we are is to open something at the coast and maybe in Portland as well. It was bittersweet. It was really hard to say goodbye to our little space on Mississippi Avenue that gave us so much. It was such a place for a lot of growth for myself and for my staff, my team, who are the loves of my life. I love all of them, and I see them as my family. But we're hoping that, you know, once this transition passes, that we're able to find our new home in our new space. I think, in a way, we dodged a bullet, to be honest, because right now my heart goes out to all of my friends who, again, they're making the best of it. There, a lot of them are just warriors, really changing and being creative and innovating. But I know it's hard, and I know it's not easy. And having been a business owner myself with a brick and mortar, it's brutal. It's hard work. And, you know, our margins are tight to begin with, and any additional stressors just can be highly detrimental. So for me, I feel lucky that, you know, I didn't sign that new lease, but also saddened that right now I don't have a home. You know, it feels, you know, I have still so much to do and a lot to say. But right now, I think the smarter business move is to just take a beat, take a moment, observe, contribute and help wherever I can, and still be able to somehow express myself through different, you know, ways, so I don't start going crazy. So, yeah.
Well, I truly hope that wherever your path leads you in the future, that part of it stays here in Portland, because
Thank you.
I think that our city would be weaker without your voice and your talent contributing to everything that makes it wonderful here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. That really made me cry. that's really sweet. Thank you so much. You know, it is such a vibrant community, and I have, from day one, I've been received with such open arms, and I feel really grateful and very lucky, because I know it's not the case all the time, and it could have gone really differently for me. It was very difficult, you know, when we first opened the restaurant. I had a business partner, and that didn't obviously work out very well, and that was very challenging. So I had to take a lot of reins in that first year. And then it was through my team that I had that first year, the second year, the third year, and even to the end, that really pulled me through. And I feel like that's just indicative of the heart and soul that the city still has, and that resiliency that we have.
That's incredible. Chef. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, gracias por el tiempo. Te lo agradezco de todo corazón.
Thanks for listening and for joining me in helping the voices in our marginalized communities in Portland be heard. You can find Olympia Oyster Bar on Instagram by the handle @OlympiaOysterBar and online at oobpdx.com. Watch the show's feed @MarginPodcast on Instagram, and you'll be sure to catch more delicious food and engaging stories from the good people of Portland and the surrounding areas. Find us where you find podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, etc. And if you know of someone from a marginalized community that wants to tell their story, tell them to add us on IG or have them send an email to margin.podcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
That's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you have any comments about the show, please email us at foodshow@kboo.fm. You can also get in touch on Instagram @pdxfoodshow. Our next episode will be on August 19th at 11 a.m. Until then, I'm Emily Becker. Thanks for listening.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man. I'm gonna be an artist, and I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper, and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries. I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery. Survival, and I guess I must be winning. And my story is so long I can't remember the beginning. Am I an optimist or am I a pessimist? If I see that half full, half empty cup is half full of nothingness.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español en respuesta a la